Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this pre-recorded program. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, June 30th, 2020. President Salva Kiir appoints 8 governors and 3 chief administrators.
There are loopholes in the way the appointments were made. One in particular is the underlying lack of consideration for women and youth being a huge constituency.
And the Sudanese leader promises change amid protests in Khartoum.
I have met a wide spectrum of political forces, resistance committees, and community representatives. I read with an open mind the letters I received from the resistance committees and the families of victims, in which they talked about the need to correct our past.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir issued a Republican decree Monday appointing 8 state governors and 3 chief administrators for Pibor, Rueng, and Abyei. A policy analyst with the Juba-based SAD Institute says the appointees must have met certain conditions. He says the criteria used in appointing the governors and the chief administrators is not new. Sarah Kleto Hassan Real is the only female appointee among the 8 governors. South Sudanese have expressed mixed feelings on the choice of the governors for Eastern and Western Equatorial State. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
SUD Institute analyst Agustino Teng Mayai says the appointing authorities fell short of adhering to one of the requirements of the peace agreement, which allocates 35% of positions to women. Of the newly appointed governors and administrators, only one is a woman nominated by the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLM-IO.
There are loopholes in the way the appointments were made. One in particular is the underlying lack of consideration for women and youth being a huge constituency that should be really considered in anything to do with governance or politics of the country. This is fundamental.
2 governors for Upper Nile and Jonglei states to be appointed by the SPLM-IO and South Sudan Opposition Alliance have yet to be named. Mayai says governors should immediately start managing local state governments and take a part in implementing the peace deal's objectives of restoring peace and stability. He says South Sudanese need to see an immediate end to the ongoing intercommunal fighting in Lakes State, Jonglei, and the Greater Pibor administrative area.
The lead priority for the new governors is restoring security at the state and subnational levels. This is essential considering that there have been ongoing clashes as a result of political leadership vacuum in the last few months after the agreement was partially implemented.
Mayai says the long-awaited move to appoint governors marks a critical step in implementing the peace agreement.
It's a requirement of the agreement itself, and having the governors being appointed, though it's not complete just yet, is a move in the right direction.
Mayai says appointing governors marks a big change in South Sudan's political leadership.
It shows that we're moving away from the old system, which favors those who are only inside the system, and moving towards making sure that other capable citizens are deployed to do the same work that others who are in the system are doing right now. So this is a move in the right direction.
The parties to the peace deal have yet to appoint state ministers, heads of commissions, and county commissioners, not to mention reconstituting national and state parliaments. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Residents of the twin cities of Khartoum and Omdurman have taken to the streets to demand for swift reforms in Sudan. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok says his government will fulfill the demands for justice, peace, democratic transition and economic reforms in the country. The head of Sudan's transitional government delivered a televised speech Monday, urging Sudanese to exercise their freedom of speech and assembly peacefully while abiding by health directives at mass gatherings to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The prime minister says his government will take actions to fulfill the demands of the Sudanese protesting on the streets of Khartoum. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Washington.
On the eve of today's rally celebrating the end of ousted President Omar al-Bashir's rule, Prime Minister Hamdok told citizens in Arabic that he has been meeting with the organizers of the rallies, including families of victims killed during the protests to topple Bashir, grassroots organizations and political parties.
I have met a wide spectrum of political forces, resistance committees and community representatives. I read with an open mind the letters I received from the resistance committees and the families of victims in which they talked about the need to correct our past. These are legitimate demands that the transitional government will fulfill in the best way possible in the coming 2 weeks.
Washington-based Sudanese analyst Suleiman Baldo says citizens took to the streets in Khartoum and other states across the country to urge the transitional government to achieve the goals of the December 2018 revolution, including justice for the victims of the military crackdown in Khartoum and improve economic conditions.
They feel that many of these objectives have not been achieved, and this is their way to remind the government that they really need to expedite the realization of the demands of the revolution. Also, among the organizers and the forces that have a lot of appeal and following in the Sudanese public are the families of the many victims of the violent dispersal on the 3rd of June.
In September 2019, Hamdok appointed a committee to investigate the day military forces killed more than 100 people as they violently dispersed a peaceful sit-in of protesters demanding the army hand over power to civilians. The committee has yet to release its results. In his speech last night, Hamdok urged those attending today's rallies to observe all COVID-19 preventative measures.
My plea to you as you exercise your rights to peaceful speech and demands is to take utmost care and follow health directives that prevent the spread of coronavirus in order to protect ourselves and the nation from an outbreak. And I fully trust your wisdom and your commitment to nonviolence at the rallies.
Sudan's constitutional document that guides the transitional period calls for achieving peace with rebel groups in Darfur, Blue Nile and southern Kordofan states, the formation of a civilian and independent judiciary, and the formation of commissions on human rights, transitional justice and judicial reforms. None of that happened yet. Hamdok says he has heard the demands of citizens and will take immediate action to fulfill those demands.
You will hear in the coming days a number of decisions regarding the path of the transitional period, some of which will have significant impacts politically, economically, and socially. Some parties may try to use that to agitate and create instability in the country. I call upon you to be wise and careful. We will triumph together through our unity and the commitment to the goals of our glorious revolution.
Baldo says Mr. Hamdok is most likely talking about economic reforms to ease the hardships of most Sudanese who live below the poverty line.
Prime Minister Hamdok is basically trying to prepare the public opinion to tough economic measures to address the root causes of the protracted economic crisis that Sudan has been going through these recent years, but which in recent months has really been aggravated through severe shortages in essential commodities, and also the lockdown has caused a lot of economic hardship for the population.
Sudan's inflation rate stands at 114% and has caused a sharp rise in the prices of commodities, including food. Baldo says the transitional government is expected to take bold measures to rebuild the economy by lifting fuel subsidies, which he says are draining the economy, and crack down on widespread corruption left over from the 30-year rule of ousted President Bashir. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Still on Sudanese affairs, a Sudanese analyst says the funds pledged by international friends of Sudan during last week's Sudan's Partnership Conference in Germany should be used to boost the country's economy. More than 50 countries and international organizations pledged $1.8 billion to facilitate the transitional period in Sudan. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The conference marked the formal start of the international community's financial support to the transitional government after 30 years of the sanction under the rule of the ousted President Omar al-Bashir. The pledges include support to help stabilize Sudan's economy and provide a safety net program for the neediest Sudanese families, about 80% of the population. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus from London, Sudanese economist Jawhara Kanu says the pledges are certainly welcome, but will not be enough to solve Sudan's problems.
However, given Sudan's deteriorating economic situation and the global financial crisis that's been storming the global economy, it could be viewed as a generous grant. In the year 2018 alone, Sudan has lost 67% of its GDP. And the situation is even expected to deteriorate further because the forecasts at the moment actually predict negative growth for this year, 2020, and even further negative growth in the year 2021.
Sudanese economic analyst Samah Salman says the transitional government should be grateful for the pledges at a time when it is facing an economic crisis. Salman says Sudan must prioritize development in rural areas so people don't migrate to cities. She also says international donations alone will not solve the problem of the Sudan's economy.
And the government is simply not able to keep up, which means that the people living below the poverty line, which currently is estimated now to have reached 70 to 80%, will continue to increase. You will see in the coming months the people living below the poverty line going up, which is a very, very serious concern.
The Sudanese Central Bureau of Statistics says the inflation in rural areas was up to 127.38% in May, compared to 107% in April this year. Muhammad Abdurrahman Al-Nair, spokesperson for Sudan Liberation Movement, Abdul Wahid Faction, downplayed the international pledges, saying the money will not solve the Sudan's economic crisis.
I don't think that the pledge will solve the economic issues of Sudan. The Sudan suffers from debts, economic collapse, and United States sanctions. I don't know the government plans to employ this support, but the provision of fuel, flour, and medicines commodities is one of the necessary things that citizens need at the moment.
Khartoum resident Omar Al-Jali says some of the international donations should be used to provide services to citizens.
Some of the sectors that we hope the donation goes towards include the infrastructure in all its kind, from railways, water drying system, waste management, airports. The most important sectors needed now in Sudan is the health sector.
Even though the conference represents a huge amount of international support, pledges fare far short of the $8 billion Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok had previously said Sudan will need to rescue its fluttering economy. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, health officials in South Sudan have some good news. Stay tuned for that story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
Can you share an inspirational quote and where you heard it from?
Heavy rains are a reminder of challenges in life. Never ask for a lighter rain. Just pray for better umbrella. I just came across it while I was reading something on social media.
This quote I just added from church, the father was like, "For those who seek, always find, and so fight endlessly for what you want for the future."
Friends are like buttons on the lift. They either bring you down or take you up. I heard it while I was in secondary school and it stuck since then.
وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا. Whoever fears Allah will have solution to whatever problems. It is from the Holy Quran.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Modou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. In our Tuesday health segment, we take a look at the COVID-19 rate of infections in South Sudan. Health officials in South Sudan say the number of COVID-19 positive cases has declined in the past few weeks. The officials say the trend indicates that some progress has been made in containing the spread of the coronavirus. But the undersecretary in the health ministry says it's too early to relax. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
South Sudan Health Ministry Undersecretary Mayen Machut Achek told reporters in Juba on Sunday health officials are seeing a decrease in the number of COVID-19 cases, being for the first time since the country recorded its first case.
Following the trends of the last 2 weeks since I joined, and perhaps even 3 weeks from before, our trends are not as scary as at the time of the outset of the virus. And that is something pleasing that we would like to maintain.
Achek also notes that unlike in the past, fewer people are turning up for coronavirus testing at the Dr. John Garang Infectious Disease Unit in Juba. Achek says South Sudan now records from 10 to 30 COVID-19 cases per day, compared to the more than 50 in previous weeks. He says a decline in cases could be attributed to the fact that more people are daring to preventive measures. Dr. Matthew Toot, the deputy incident manager for COVID-19 at the health ministry, says there are a number of factors behind the drop in the number of people testing positive for COVID-19, and that the declining number of positive cases may not paint a true picture of what is happening in South Sudan.
More cases that we are seeing now, they came from the travelers that were screened, and then the contacts. So when the travelers' testing was stopped, we see a massive decline in the sample that are being tested. That is one. And again, also among the contacts, I think the stigma is real, and people are not willing to share with the contact tracing their contacts. Okay, and we are seeing a drop in the contacts that are being traced. So those could explain why we are seeing less cases that are being confirmed.
Dr. Joseph Wamala, the WHO's Country Preparedness and International Health Regulation Officer, says a decline in positive cases should be investigated further.
We need to look at the trends of severe cases that are admitted in IDU. We need to also monitor the alerts that are coming into the call center. Then we also, most importantly, as I mentioned when we were starting, we need to have our eyes in the community. Until we have our eyes in the community, we are in touch with the Boma health workers, and they indicate to us that they are not seeing any people who are sick or dying from symptoms suggestive of COVID, then we cannot confidently say that we are really on top of the situation.
Dr. Wamala says Juba can be the best place to conduct a quick survey to authenticate the declining number of cases.
We're working on doing a community survey, at least in Juba. This will be a household survey. And we believe the information from this survey will also help us to get answers on what the real trends are at the community level.
As of Monday, South Sudan recorded just over 2,000 COVID-19 cases, 37 deaths and 261 recoveries. WHO and South Sudan Health Ministry officials are urging people to continue social distancing and wearing masks. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Still on COVID, Kenya's tourism sector has lost $752 million in revenue since the outbreak of COVID-19 3 months ago. Speaking on Monday in Nairobi, Tourism Cabinet Secretary Najib Balala said Kenya can only manage to recover 30% of the loss during the 2020-2021 financial year once the country reopens its economy. As Maureen Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, hotels and travel agencies have sent their employees on unpaid leave as most of them struggle to sustain themselves.
Tourism is among the main sectors contributing to economic growth of Kenya with at least 21% and closure of the airspace. Cessation of inter-county movement as a way of containing the spread of COVID-19 immensely contributed to revenue loss. Tourism Cabinet Secretary Najib Balala said that with the cases of the virus now above 6,000 mark and counting, the sector has already lost 50% of its revenues.
We lost almost 80 billion Kenya shillings. So that is almost 0.8 million. So we lost 50% of our revenue of 1.6 billion. So the first half we got it. The second half is literally as good as zero. So we have a major problem. We lost 50% of our revenue.
In 2018-2019 financial year, the sector received more than 2 million tourist arrivals, bringing in tourism revenue of Kenya shillings 164 billion. Balala says at the moment, the sector will depend on domestic tourism as the international tourism is projected to remain affected until mid-2021.
For 2020-2021, which is starting from 1st of July, we're only going to get back less than 30%. From the 6th of July, because the country will open up, definitely we know there'll be some international tourism coming in December because of the holidays, but proper international recovery will be in summer 2021. So that is our projection so far.
Thousands of employees in the sector have been laid off as most companies closed down due to economic difficulties. However, Mr. Balala says those rendered redundant at workplace once the economy reopens will be given priority.
People employed in the tourism sector are above 2 million, but you know now we have a lockdown, so the entire tourism sector is out of business at the moment, so there are major job losses. But we have been assured immediately we start opening, even the people who have been sent home on redundancy, the minute the economy starts picks up, they'll be the first people who will be given the priority to come back because they're already skilled and trained.
The tourism industry in Kenya contributes greatly to national development through employment creation, environmental conservation and management, income generation, source of foreign exchange, among other benefits, with all these subsectors having been negatively affected. On July 6th, President Uhuru Kenyatta is expected to address the nation on the review of the containment measures that have so far been given, including the cessation of movement in and out of Nairobi, Mombasa, and Mandera counties, as well as the dusk to dawn curfew. Reporting for VOA, I am Maureen Odhiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
And here in the United States, over the weekend, one person died and another was injured in a shooting late on Saturday in Louisville, Kentucky's Jefferson Square Park, which has become a center for protests against the police killing of a black woman in her home in March. Despite the dangers, the protesters show no sign of slowing down. VOA's Ian Bure looks at the sustained motivation of these protests with reporting from VOA's Asia Sarai.
At advocates for racial justice say that the protests seen across the United States in the past month are not new, organic, or solely because of George Floyd's death. The movement has been built on years of organizing and a growing list of individuals killed at the hands of police. Cornell W. Brooks is the former president of the civil rights group NAACP.
It arrives at a moment in which the public's patience for police misconduct has been expended. And so the George Floyd video arrives after the video of Philando Castile in Minneapolis, after the video of Jamar Clark in Minneapolis, but also after the video of Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Laquan McDonald.
Some demonstrators have noted how the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to the sustained motivation of nationwide protest. Hilda Johnson is a protester in Washington, D.C.
Like, I already have to fight systemic racism. I have to fight, like, a virus that I do not understand, that no one understands. And you're still killing me on national TV? Like, just something's got to give.
This year, social media, fundraisers, and petitions have accompanied rallies in the streets.
You have the highest unemployment rate you've ever seen before. People actually have the time right now to go out into the streets. Now you realize that you and your friends can, you know, create a petition, can sign something, can, you know, get folks out on the street, can volunteer to bring water.
Black Americans who have taken to the streets in recent weeks note that discrimination and violence against them is nothing new. Like this protester, who gave her first name as Sonia.
I live it, right? Because I was born a black woman, right? So this is not something that I'm just coming to realize.
Activists note that an increase of organizing and educating on social media has contributed to wider awareness of the movement. Former NAACP President Brooks.
Young people crafting hashtags, crafting messages, engaged in serial strategic disruption of daily life, globalizing the message, tying it to a set of public policy reforms, and pushing the conversation, changing the civic vocabulary.
While specific circumstances of the 2020 protests for the Black Lives Matter movement are different than previous ones, Brooks believes the current movement is the result of years of organizing.
Based on my 25 years of doing this work around the country, This is a serious moment at the dawn of a movement. I thought so 5 years ago. I don't think I was wrong.
Brooks and grassroots activists are confident this current movement will affect real change, noting it has already sparked conversation about police reform in both the local and federal governments. Ayan Bior with reporting from Aisha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Sowata by Emmanuel Kembe. We've been listening to Emmanuel Kembe with the song Sowata. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for making us part of your evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.